Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello there, and welcome to another classic replay from the Unbelievable podcaster. We've been bringing you these conversations that matter for over a decade and a half now, and we love pulling out some classics from the past. Got a great one for you today. In November 2010, I featured renowned Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga on the show to debate the evolutionary argument against naturalism, one of his most famous arguments against atheism and in favour of theism. He was met by a worthy opponent, atheist philosopher Stephen Law. Do hope you enjoy it. And don't forget, you can keep up to date with the latest from the show, get in touch, and find many more of these evergreen debates on big questions at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Well, welcome, gentlemen, both. We have here in the studio Stephen Law, and on the phone from the States, we've got Alvin Plantinga. Alvin, let's start with you, as you, in a way, are going to be presenting and defending this evolutionary argument against naturalism today. But I'm just interested in the fact that you are a professor of philosophy. You're noted worldwide, not just because you are a professor of philosophy, but you're particularly defending the Christian, as it were, view of God. And I don't know, is it true that there's been something of, I suppose you could say, a revival in Christian philosophy in the last few years? What's your view on that?
Well, there certainly has been, in the United States at least. I mean, when I was a graduate student coming out of graduate school, which by now is uncomfortably long ago, there were very few Christian philosophers in the United States, or at least there were very few who were sort of, you might say, outed, would actually consider themselves Christian philosophers and be prepared to argue as Christian philosophers. Now that's very different. There are some 1,100 members of the Society of Christian Philosophers and another 1,100 or 1,200 members of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, plus lots of members of the American Catholic Philosophical Society, so that's very different. And I suppose the bulk of these people are young people. So there has indeed been a considerable change. There's no question about it.
What's been behind that change then? Because I think many people do have in their mind that most philosophy departments are stacked full of atheists, and that there's a sort of natural correlation between atheism and being a philosophy professor or studying philosophy. What's caused at least this change in the numbers of Christian philosophers, would you say?
Well, first, I don't think there has to be any particular connection between atheism and philosophy. Many times in the past, of course, there have been a predominance of Christian philosophers. But it is true, though, that the bulk of the philosophical community in the United States, and certainly in Britain as well, would be people who are naturalists or atheists or agnostics. But as to why there's been this change in the U.S., I really don't know. I think these things are extremely hard to figure out. There was a sort of resurgence of evangelical Christianity starting in the 70s or so. And, of course, the United States is a rather seriously Christian, seriously theistic country as compared to many of the countries in Europe. But as to why this happened, I don't know. I don't know if there's any good way to tell.
Well, it's great to have you on the program, and we're going to be hearing from you about your very interesting argument. The first time I came across it, it really struck me as almost ironic in the fact that you're using what is traditionally seen as, you know, the tool of people like Richard Dawkins to suggest that science has trumped religion in terms of evolution. But you're using it actually to suggest actually, no, the evolution, if we take it to be true, is actually a defeater of atheism. We'll come to that in a moment, and obviously Stephen, I'm sure, will start to weigh in at that point. Another little issue that I wanted to draw you out on a bit, Alvin, before we progress, is that we've been doing a lot about intelligent design recently on this programme. We have Michael Behe coming over to the UK for a tour, and I'm actually going to be hosting one of those events in London in November, well, later this month, November the 22nd. But you have actually been outed, supposedly at least, by Michael Roos. In March this year, he published an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education claiming that you are an open enthusiast of intelligent design. I understand you responded in the form of a letter to the editor, but where do you actually stand on the whole issue of intelligent design?
Well, Michael Roos writes about me every now and then, and typically it's not really flattering. And he apparently thinks if you say that someone's an open enthusiast for intelligent design, that's a little like saying they're an open enthusiast for, say, racism or beating up little children. I don't see why that should be. I don't think that's the case of being outed. I mean, that's just what somebody's view might be. But as for my views on intelligent design, like any believer in God, I think the world has been intelligently designed by God, who is an intelligent being. But that's not enough to be a member or a follower of the intelligent design movement. To be part of that, you must also think that you can give scientific arguments, or possibly quasi-scientific arguments, for the conclusion that our world is, in fact, intelligently designed. And on that, I'm a little iffy. I mean, I'm sort of sympathetic to the idea, but I don't find those arguments overwhelmingly convincing. I think they're rather plausible, but I don't think they're totally convincing. I mean, there are basically two kinds of such arguments. On the one hand, there are what you might call cosmological arguments about the universe is being fine-tuned. You know, there are these various parameters that have to be tuned very finely for there to be life, or at least life as we know it. The force of gravity, the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, rate of expansion of the universe, and so on, all these things, they have to be very finely tuned in order for there to be life. And so you might think, well, it's much more likely that these constants would be very finely tuned, given theism, given that there is a God who wanted to create human beings, or these create people who create living beings, people who could, and beings who could be in touch with him, than on naturalism or than on chance. And I guess I'm inclined to go along with that, but I doubt if that argument is strong enough to support the kind of belief people who believe in God really do have, which is much firmer than the suggestion. It's more likely than not, I would say.
I think that's interesting. And obviously, in a sense, the argument we're talking about today sort of relates to this whole area, because it is that sense that evolution is a completely unguided process and it exists in a completely naturalistic framework, which is what you're critiquing, whether that even makes sense in and of itself when you actually ask, well, what do we believe when we talk about evolution? But we'll come to that in a moment. Let's introduce our other guest, who is Stephen Law. And as I said, he is a senior lecturer in philosophy at Heathrop College, which is a part of the University of London, and also Provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK. So thank you very much for joining me today, Stephen.
My pleasure.
Second time on the show. Glad we didn't scare you off too much last time. You've come back for more.
Yes.
I asked Alvin, you know, why the resurgence in interest among Christians in philosophy in the US. I mean, have you noticed that? Have you found yourself doing more of these kinds of engagements with Christian philosophers? Do you think philosophy is still predominantly atheist rule the roost, as it were, in contemporary philosophy?
Well, in the UK, I can't say that I've noticed a great resurgence in the number of Christian philosophers. That may be true in America. I'm not really in a position to judge. But it's certainly true, I think, that the majority of professional philosophers and philosophy graduate students, they don't sign up to theism. There was a poll conducted about a year and a half ago, I think, by Phil Papers, which was an international poll, I think, and they asked professional philosophers and philosophy graduate students what views they held about a range of different topics, and it turned out that around about 72% of the philosophers asked described themselves as atheist, less than 15% as holding some kind of theism. Whereas, interestingly, only around about 50% of the philosophers asked said that they signed up to naturalism, which is something we're going to discuss.
Now, that's interesting that they would distinguish between the two. I would often think of the two as being inextricably linked in some way, but I guess that isn't an assumption you should necessarily jump to. You're listening to Unbelievable, the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together. Don't forget we're online and this podcast available now at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Also posting up links to both my guests' websites where you can find out more about their work and indeed other relevant podcasts from the Unbelievable back catalogue that you may want to listen to as well if you're interested in this whole area. So coming back to you, Alvin, this evolutionary argument against naturalism, it's almost backwards, because people such as Richard Dawkins, you know, are famed for saying that the Darwinian evolution, as it were, gives an intellectual basis for being an atheist, you know, that after Darwin, people were able to be intellectually fulfilled atheists. But your argument says something very, very different. Perhaps you'd like to guide us through and I think, you know, if you assume that I know a little but not a lot about this argument, that would probably be good. And tell us, where does it come from, and why do you believe that that the truth of evolution is actually a defeater of naturalism?
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, I think you should introduce me and Stephen to each other.
Well, that's a good idea. I'm glad someone's got manners around here. let me introduce you to each other, gentlemen. And the first time you've spoken to each other, I am assuming.
Yes, it is. I've never spoken. Yeah. And it's a great honour. I mean, Alvin is one of the great philosophers of religion, and I admire his work. It's always interesting, even if I don't always agree with it.
And I'm delighted to meet Stephen. I've seen some of his things online, and it's a pleasure.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, introduction's done, and my apologies for not making them before. Would you guide us into this argument of yours, Alvin?
Yeah. One more little preliminary. Stephen mentioned this poll that was taken, and the numbers he gave are the numbers I remember, too. I think it's worth noting, I don't think numbers are that important in this particular context, but I think it is worth noting that the proportion, that the percentage of graduate students who were believers in God was about 1.5 times as large as the percentage of philosophers generally, which sort of fits in with the thought that here in the United States, at least, there is a kind of a serious resurgence of Christian belief among philosophers. But now, as to the evolutionary argument, it's really an argument against naturalism, which I take to be the idea that there isn't any such person as God or anything like God. So if naturalism is stronger than atheism, you could be an atheist without rising to the full heights or descending to the full depths of naturalism. But if you're a naturalist, you have to be an atheist. And my argument is for the conclusion that if you accept both naturalism and evolution, and I take it naturalists almost all do accept evolution, then you've got a real problem. the conclusion is that the conclusion of the argument is that that combination of naturalism and evolution is incoherent. It shoots itself in the foot, you might say. It's self-defeating. And the argument involves, is really about our cognitive faculties, the faculties that produce belief in us and by which we know things, memory, for example, or perception, whereby we know something about what's going on in the world around us, or logical intuition, whereby we know truths of logic and maybe mathematical propositions and so on. And, of course, there are no doubt other ones as well, but those are some of our cognitive faculties, and we take it for granted ordinarily that these faculties are reliable. That is, that they produce a preponderance of true beliefs as opposed to false beliefs. Not all the beliefs have to be true, of course, but some substantial preponderance, so that, you know, most of the time when I believe that I'm seeing a tree, well, I am, in fact, seeing a tree. Now, my argument goes like this. The first premise is that, we could put it like this, isn't exactly right, but it's close. If naturalism and evolution were both true, then the probability that our cognitive faculties would be reliable is low, all right? So if they were both true, then that probability would be low. The probability that our faculties are reliable would be low. And the second premise is that anybody who believes naturalism and evolution and also sees that the first premise is true, that is, that the probability that our faculties should be reliable given naturalism and evolution is low, anybody who believes naturalism and evolution and sees that that first premise is true has a defeater for the proposition that her cognitive faculties are reliable, a reason to give that belief up, a reason to reject it, to not believe it. And then the next premise is, if you have a defeater for the proposition that your faculties are reliable, you also have a defeater for any belief you take to be produced by those faculties. If you can't sensibly believe that your faculties are reliable, then you also have a defeater for any belief that those faculties produce. And of course, that's all of them, since they have, all of our beliefs are produced by our cognitive faculties. But then that means, and here's the conclusion, that means you have a defeater for naturalism and evolution itself, for that combination, naturalism and evolution. So that naturalism and evolution is such that if you believe it, then you get a defeater for it.
Mm.
So you might say it shoots itself in the foot, and you can't.
It's kind of, you've sort of sawn off the branch that you were sitting on, as it were. And this is, in a sense, as I understand it, when you say that, you know, evolution is not particularly there to generate true beliefs. This is because obviously evolution is about survival of the fittest, and it's about producing beliefs that lead to survival. And those don't necessarily always, they wouldn't necessarily be true beliefs. And I think you give the example quite often in when you're talking about this of someone who runs into a tiger. Why do they run away? Is it because of a true belief that they are worried they're going to be eaten? Or could be that, in fact, the belief is simply that they think running away from a tiger is a fun thing to do. But isn't actually a true belief as far as the what that tiger is going to do to them. I'm not explaining it very well, I think that it's important to draw that out a little bit. Evolution isn't set up necessarily to produce true beliefs.
Right. I think, really, you're asking about the first premise, you know, which is that the probability of our faculties being reliable, given naturalism and evolution, is low. And central to that is the thought that evolution isn't interested in true belief. It's interested in adaptive behavior, getting your body parts in the right place so that you survive and can reproduce. That's what evolution, you might say, is interested in, if you want to personify evolution. But I would put it like this. My reason for thinking that first premise is true, that the probability that our faculties are reliable given naturalism and evolution is low, I would put it like this. First of all, think of naturalism as including materialism about human beings. So that if you're a naturalist, you'll also think that human beings don't have an immaterial self or soul, but are material objects through and through. Maybe what a person is just his or her body or some part of his or her body, all right? So then think about it like this. I mean, and think about some other creatures, not ourselves, but some hypothetical creatures on some other planet, maybe a kind of thought experiment. And suppose that naturalism and evolution, and now materialism as part of naturalism, holds for them. Well, their behavior we know is adaptive because we can get that from the idea that they have evolved and survived. And that behavior is caused by an underlying neurology of some sort. Processes in their brains, neurons fire, send signals down efferent nerves to muscles. Muscles are caused to contract, and the result is behavior. And that neurology then is also adaptive because it produces or causes adaptive behavior. So we can say it's adaptive too. And the neurology also produces or determines belief, all right? The thought that some proposition is true, maybe that all men are mortal, or maybe that it's 5 hours later in the UK than it is in the US. It doesn't matter. But the point would be that it doesn't matter to the adaptiveness of the beliefs, the adaptiveness of the underlying neurology. It doesn't matter what belief it also determines or causes. If it causes true belief, that's fine. If it causes false belief, that's okay too. But if that's the case, then if you pick one of these, any belief on the part of one of these creatures we're thinking about, the likelihood that a given belief will be true would have to be thought to be about a half. And if the likelihood of any given belief being true is about a half, then the probability that their beliefs are reliable, that their faculties are reliable, that's going to be pretty low.
Hmm.
So that's basically the reason.
Yeah, and so in a sense, you say that you have to call in God as the guarantor, if you like, of the belief being true, because we're not in any sense guaranteed under a purely evolutionary naturalistic framework that the belief will be true, and therefore God, as it were, is a very rational thing to if you want evolution to definitely be true, then we need God as the guarantor that we are. Our mental faculties produce the true beliefs that we have about things like evolution.
Yeah, well, I think something like that. I mean, given if you're a believer in God, if you're, say, a Christian theist, or for that matter, a Jewish or Muslim theist, you'll think that God has created people, human beings, in his own image. And part of that is having, as he does, having knowledge about our world and about ourselves and about God himself. So, given theism, you would expect that our cognitive faculties would be, for the most part, reliable. And my argument here is that, given naturalism, you can't have that expectation at all.
Well, we had to kind of give quite a long sort of explanation there of the strands of this argument, Stephen. But perhaps you'd like to begin by just telling us where you think the main problem is. And I'll tell you what. Before you launch in, let's go to a slightly early break, because I don't want you to start and then 2 minutes in I have to cut you off in mid-flow. We're going to go to a quick break here, and you're listening to an argument on a philosophical argument. I do hope that you're able to keep up. I'm certainly going to be trying to sort of keep things at a level where hopefully a good number of people can join in on this this question of whether evolution is a defeater of naturalism. This is the so-called evolutionary argument against naturalism. On the phone I've got Alvin Plantinga, who is one of the foremost Christian philosophers in the world and currently Professor of Philosophy at Calvin College. He says that the theory of evolution, if we take it to be true, defeats a thoroughgoing atheist naturalism. On the other side of this debate is atheist philosopher Stephen Law from Heathrop College, and he is putting the other side. He's going to be in the next section of the programme starting to critique some of what we've heard from Alvin in the first part of today's programme.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We've got quite an in-depth philosophical edition of the programme today. We are talking to two philosophers. One is a Christian, one is an atheist. Our Christian philosopher is probably one of the foremost Christian philosophers in the world. It's a great honour to have him on the phone today from the States, Alvin Plantinga. He's talking about the evolutionary argument against naturalism. We heard him spelling it out in the first part of the programme, but essentially it comes to the point where if evolution is the thing that produces our beliefs, in a naturalistic framework, we have no actual good reason to trust the beliefs that it produces, including our belief in the theory of evolution in that sense. So that's, if you like, in a nutshell, and that's an extremely basic way of putting it. But Stephen is with us in the studio. Stephen Law, atheist philosopher, senior lecturer in philosophy at Heathrop College at the University of London and provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK. Links to both my guests with the podcast of this programme at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Okay, Stephen, so just start us off with some of your sort of questions and comments on the argument, and then we'll sort of bring Alvin in, and you feel free to kind of just wade in, Alvin, during the course of the coming discussion as well.
Right, okay, well... Well, I don't think I should be wading in with criticisms just yet. I think it would probably be helpful if we just got a little bit clearer about exactly what the argument is and what its conclusion is supposed to be. So, well, maybe Alvin can answer this question for me. Is the conclusion that naturalism or the combination of naturalism and evolution is not true or is unlikely to be true?
No. Excuse me, that's not the conclusion.
Right.
The conclusion is rather that it's not a belief one can rationally accept. And of course, there's a difference.
Yes.
I can't rationally accept the belief that, I don't know, that nobody believes anything, even though that could be true. So it's one thing to say that a certain proposition is false, another to say that you can't rationally accept it. And I'm saying the latter about this combination of natural.
Yeah, okay. No, so that's good. So I just wanted to clear that up, because so many times I've heard people refer to Alvin's argument as an argument which establishes that naturalism isn't true or is unlikely to be true, and that's not even the intention of the argument. Even if it were cogent, it's not supposed to establish that. So,
right.
We'll put that issue to one side. What it is supposed to establish, as you say, is that if we believe the combination of naturalism and the theory of evolution, then we end up with this defeater for our belief in naturalism and evolution. Now, that's and it's an interesting argument, and it does turn crucially on this first premise, as Justin pointed out, that if naturalism and evolution are true, then the probability that we have reliable cognitive faculties must be pretty low. And you sketched out a little, Alvin sketched out a little argument for why we ought to think that. Maybe just to sharpen up your argument, what if I do this? I'll give you what I think must have crossed the minds of many people listening to this program, a sort of explanation for why surely evolution would select for true belief-producing mechanisms. And the suggestion would go something like this. Presumably, organisms such as us, ourselves, need water and food and a mate, and so natural selection will tend to produce in us desires for those kinds of things. Those desires by themselves, of course, don't produce behaviour. You also need to have beliefs. And so suppose that I crave water, I'm thirsty, suppose there's water to the south of me but nowhere else. If I have the belief that there's water to the south, then I'll go south and I'll get water and I'll survive. If I believe there's water to the north, a false belief, I'll go north and I'll die. So it looks on the face of it as if natural selection is going to favour beliefs that are true or cognitive mechanisms that are going to tend to produce true beliefs. Now, obviously, you, Alvin, would reject that little account that I've given as to why natural selection will favour true beliefs. So if you could just explain exactly what's wrong with it, I think everyone would be then a lot clearer about precisely what the objection is.
Sure. Let's back up a little bit. Let's think about a frog sitting on a lily pond, and a fly whizzes by. The frog's tongue flicks out and captures the fly, which, of course, contributes to the frog's survival and reproductive prospects, let's say. So there must be neurology in the frog that tracks the fly and determines how far the fly is away and what its velocity is and the like of that. There must be indicators in the frog that that accurately indicate these things. If they didn't accurately indicate them, the frog wouldn't capture the fly, and it would be in much worse condition. That underlying neurology, we could suppose, also produces belief. Maybe given a certain kind of neurology, it just follows that certain beliefs are also present, certain belief content is also present. But it doesn't matter as far as the frog's capturing the fly is concerned. Doesn't matter as far as that underlying neurology, its adaptiveness is concerned, whether or not that belief content is true. Could be true, that's fine. Could equally well be false. All that really counts is that the underlying neurology produced the right kind of behavior. And I said we should think about these other creatures, which are much like us, and some other planet maybe, or some other universe where naturalism is true and evolution is true. The same would go for them. There would be this underlying neurology which causes adaptive behavior and also determines belief or belief content. But it just doesn't matter whether the belief content that it produces is true or false. All that really matters is that that underlying neurology cause the right kind of signals to go down efferent nerves to the right muscles, causing them to contract, thereby causing adaptive behavior. And if that's the case, then, again, as I say, you'd have to suppose, with respect to any particular belief, that the probability of its being true is no better than the probability of its being false, in which case the probability that they have reliable cognitive faculties would be pretty low. That's I hope that's clear to everybody. I mean, that's about as well as I can do there.
Yeah. I mean, that helps a lot. So, I mean, this is where it becomes, it can quickly become more complicated, the argument. So,
and that's the trouble.
So I'll try and articulate a worry about what you've just said. Which is this? I mean, it must be. Maybe it's true that natural selection is not interested in the truth of beliefs per se. What it's interested in is getting the right behavior produced, adaptive behavior. But if beliefs are associated with, say, certain neural structures, if they are just those neural structures, or if well, let's just suppose for the sake of argument that they are. Surely you can't just plug any old belief into any old neural structure willy-nilly. There are, if you like, conceptual constraints on what particular belief a particular neural structure might be. So if we were to take, for example, my neural structure, which produces my behavior that I go south to find water, in conjunction with my strong desire for water, if it has that kind of behavioral output, it's hardly likely to be the belief that there's water to the north. The most likely candidate belief is that there's water to the south, and that is the belief which then gets selected for, a true belief. That's kind of the worry.
Uh-huh. Yeah, see, now, of course, I'm taking it that we're thinking about this from the point of view of materialism about human beings. And we can suppose then, as you suggest, that maybe a belief just is a certain neural structure. But it's important in this context not to think about how things actually are so much as how things would be if both materialism and naturalism and evolution, if all three of these things were true. I mean, you say it's very unlikely that the belief content that would get associated with the neural structures that partly cause you to go towards the water in the south should be the content that there's water to the north. But I wonder why you think that. I mean, I don't see where that likelihood judgment comes from. It's certainly true that's how we think about ourselves as things stand. But we can't take it for granted in the argument that that materialism is true. We have to, I mean, that's part of what's at issue here.
Well, I mean, I'm not necessarily wedded to naturalism or materialism even, but what I was thinking of was this thought that, I mean, even if the belief is not identical with the neural structure, if it's associated with a particular neural structure, that association, that causal connection or whatever it is, you can't just plug any old belief into that neural structure, because it seems to me there are sort of conceptual constraints on what we can call the belief that there's water to the south, and some of these constraints involve what kinds of effect on behavior, for example, that particular state has. And once we've acknowledged that, then it seems to me that we can now see how natural selection is going to favor beliefs that tend to be true.
Well, there, I guess I'd first of all agree that not just any old belief can go with just any old neural structure. People who think about these things, hard philosophers of mind, often think about supervenience in this context, and so they say that a given belief content will be determined by underlying neurological properties, and maybe that's correct, and from the point of view of materialism, that seems very sensible. So given a certain kind of underlying neurology, a certain particular belief will be determined, not just any belief, but some particular one. But I can't see why one should think that that particular belief that gets associated with the underlying neurology, when the underlying neurology causes a given kind of behavior, let's say, I can't see why one should think that it just has to be the case that that belief is connected somehow with whatever it is that whatever kind of action it is that issues from the underlying neurology.
Right.
That may be so, but it might just well not be so. It's not something one can just, so to speak, count on.
Yeah, no, well, I wasn't suggesting that. I mean, what I'm suggesting is that if the belief produces, in conjunction with a strong desire for water, movement in the direct, you know, in a southerly direction, then it's a very strong candidate for being the belief that there's water to the south. I mean, maybe it isn't. It's possible that it's not that belief. I'll acknowledge that possibility. But surely it becomes a very strong candidate, whereas the belief that there's water to the north, it's a rather unlikely candidate for being that particular belief. And so it seems to me that, you know, natural selection is more likely then to favour the true belief than the false belief in this particular case, because it's more likely to be the true belief than the false belief, given that it results in that kind of behavior.
Uh-huh. Well, now that's, I guess, a point where we aren't seeing quite eye to eye. I don't see the grounds for that probability-type judgment. I mean, if we go back to the frog again, imagine the frog sitting on the lily pond and the fly comes flying by.
Yeah.
Maybe the frog has beliefs, and maybe those beliefs are determined by the underlying neurological structure. That structure causes the frog to capture the fly, but I can't see any reason why, if there are beliefs determined by that structure, they have to have anything to do with flies. I mean, maybe the frog believes something totally different, you know. Maybe the frog doesn't believe anything on that occasion about flies or little black dots, but who knows? Maybe the frog thinks, if only a beautiful princess would come along and kiss me, I would turn into a prince. Who knows? I just don't see that there has to be any particular connection between the belief content produced and the behavior.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying that it has to be the belief that, you know, there's a fly at location X in order for it, its desire for flies to produce the behavior that it sticks its tongue out and hits location X. It doesn't necessarily have to be that belief, but surely if we're going to start attributing beliefs to the frog, that's got to be pretty high up the list of beliefs, so far as, you know, it being one that the frog holds. It's hardly likely that it's going to be the belief that, you know, inflation is high, or that there's a fly at some entirely different location. I mean, that's a possibility, but it's hardly likely. In which case, surely natural selection is going to favour the
I suppose I'm interested to know, Alvin, why you believe that on naturalism, evolution has a low probability of producing true beliefs. And why? I mean, you might say we can't know whether the beliefs are true or not, you know, in a philosophical sense. But why is the probability low that they would, you know, I assume the converse is that it's a high probability they will produce, it will produce false beliefs. Why? Would, on a naturalistic framework, evolution be more likely to produce false beliefs in a person?
Well, I don't say that evolution is more likely to produce false beliefs. What I say is that given materialism, this underlying structure causes adaptive behavior and also determines a certain belief or a certain belief content. But it doesn't matter for the success or for the adaptiveness of the action whether that belief content, belief determined by the neurology, is a true belief or a false belief. Might as well be false as true. I don't say it's more likely to be false, but it just might as well be false as to be true. Mm. And if that's the case, then the probability with respect to any given belief that it should be true, you'd have to say it's about a half. But if that's the case, then the probability that, say, three-quarters of the beliefs of these creatures are true, which would be a kind of a modest requirement for the reliability of their cognitive faculties, that probability would be very low. If they have, say, 100 independent beliefs, it would be less than 1 out of 1 million, really.
So I mean, I'll move us on a bit now, because obviously at this point you've reached a sort of impasse slightly where you can't see why necessarily, you know, there would be a natural propensity for beliefs that we can't ascribe true, you know, that these are true beliefs when it comes to a naturalistic framework. I was interested by a comment you made earlier, Stephen, where you say you're not necessarily wedded to naturalism or materialism. I mean, you're an atheist, aren't you?
Yes.
So doesn't that automatically mean you don't believe there's anything beyond our physical, the physical universe, you know, the constituent elements the universe? Surely anything beyond that is stepping into theism of some kind or supernaturalism of some kind, I don't know.
Well,
anything beyond the natural.
I'm a little bit uncomfortable about the naturalist label, partly because I'm not quite sure what it means. It's a very hard thing to define, naturalism. I mean, you might say it means you don't believe in the supernatural, but then, you know, explain what supernatural means. It means kind of super to the natural world. So, you know, it's a hard thing to pin down in any non-circular way. So that's one reason why I'm a little bit uncomfortable about the label. But I'm also uncomfortable about it because, to the extent that I think, you know, I can make sense of it, there are all sorts of positions that you might hold which don't necessarily require that you sign up to belief in any particular god or gods. So, for example, you might be, I don't know, if you're a mathematician. Many mathematicians apparently are kind of Platonists about mathematics. They think that mathematics describes a kind of non-natural realm of numbers. Well, so they believe that. They're not then wedded to naturalism. But does it mean that they believe in God? I can't see why. Or suppose you think that there are certain, you know, non-natural properties, properties, you know, to do with conscious experience, are above and beyond what is natural. I don't see why, if you took that view, you'd have to believe in God or gods. So, you know, I don't think you can just run the two things together. They are quite different positions, theism. Sorry, atheism and naturalism. And, of course, that comes out in the figures I gave at the start of the programme, that philosophers, few of them sign up to theism, but then only about half of them sign up to naturalism.
I mean, your argument, Alvin, specifically deals with naturalism. Do you make the distinction that Stephen does between atheism and naturalism, that you don't necessarily...
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think naturalism is a stronger position. That is, that it entails, as I'm using the term, it entails atheism. But you could be an atheist without being a naturalist. And it is true that there are people, mathematicians, let's say, who think there are think numbers exist necessarily in some kind of Platonic realm. And naturalists, and many naturalists find that sort of objectionable. They think, well, that's sort of leaning too far away from naturalism. That's why I think a good way to think about it is a rather vague way, but still perhaps the best way, as the belief that there's no such person as God, the God of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, no such person as God or anything like God. Anything like God makes it a little vague. I mean, immaterial souls, are they too much like God to be accepted by a proper naturalist? Platonic numbers, well, those would be maybe hard to say. But still, I mean, I think that's as good as one can do with respect to defining naturalism. And I think Stephen and I are pretty much on agreement. In
yeah.
Agreement. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Well, I mean, when it comes, though, to the what your argument kind of leaves us with, Alvin, do you believe that you can only hold a rational belief in evolution if you are a theist of some description? Or is there kind of wiggle room? Can you be a sort of not a materialist naturalist, but still some kind of somewhere else and be able to hold this rational belief in evolution?
Yeah, I think there is wiggle room. I mean, you could fail to be a theist, but you might think that there is, say, as Aristotle maybe thought. I mean, I'm no expert on Aristotle, but people sometimes say Aristotle thought there's this natural teleology that points in a certain direction. And you might think, well, that's the way the world really is. There isn't any such person as God, but there is some kind of inbuilt natural teleology pointing towards and eventually producing creatures like us. We might think patting ourselves on the back. Then my argument wouldn't work with respect to a set of beliefs like that. But also, I don't think that would qualify as a proper naturalism.
Right. I mean, this argument is aimed at someone like Dawkins, for instance, who is very adamant that there is nothing but the natural, as it were, universe and its laws and the particles that exist. I mean, I wonder, is this a wrong interpretation of this particular argument, Alvin, that it kind of has similarities to, for instance, the argument from rationality for God? I'm thinking of C.S. Lewis arguing that, it makes no sense to speak of true or false beliefs if all those beliefs consist of is neurons firing and chemicals acting on each other. We don't kind of have a rational basis for talking about things in terms of true and false
right.
categories.
I guess I think that argument moves a little fast. I'm not really convinced by that argument, but mine is in the same general ballpark as that argument from C.S. Lewis. And there are other people that have proposed similar things, although not in quite such elaborate detail. For example, the philosopher Tom Nagel, and as far as that goes, so even Nietzsche. I mean, ordinarily what Nietzsche says doesn't inspire any confidence in me, but on this particular point, he might be onto something. He says something like this too, but it's only in a sentence, or maybe part of a sentence. So, I mean, the basic idea behind my argument is certainly not my invention. It's been around for some time. I think Darwin himself thought along similar lines. He says in a certain place in one of his letters, he says he's got these serious doubts as to whether minds that descended from monkey minds, whether their convictions would be true. But I mean, what I've been trying to do is to state this argument in somewhat more more detail.
Yeah, absolutely. And just in the last couple of minutes of this section, and we'll have a chance to finish off our thoughts in the final section, Stephen. You wanted to say something on the
well, report. Yeah. I mean, there are two bits to this argument. First of all, we need to show that naturalism, combined with the theory of evolution, ends up kind of a self-defeating position. But there's also the thread that theism, combined with evolution, doesn't run into that those kinds of problems. And actually, it seems to me that it does. I mean, maybe, you know, if we embrace naturalism, the theory of evolution, we'll end up in a kind of sceptical mire from which we can't escape, and we won't be able to know anything, including even that naturalism and evolution are true. But it may be that the combination of theism and evolution runs into exactly the same kind of problem. So here's a suggestion. If I suppose that there is a God of the sort that Alvin believes in, and that I have reliable cognitive faculties as a result, when I apply those faculties, it seems to me I come up with, I discover all sorts of things which reveal that in fact there is no such God, such as appalling suffering in the universe. So my cognitive faculties reveal to me that there is no God of that kind. But if there is no God of that kind, then it turns out I can't have reliable cognitive faculties. So you see, I end up in the same sceptical mire. It's a similar kind of problem that you find whether we go for naturalism or theism. Although, interestingly, there are versions of theism which wouldn't have that particular problem. I mean, if, for example, I suppose that there's a kind of a God that values knowledge, but isn't morally good or evil, isn't interested in that kind of thing, well then, you know, the fact that there's appalling suffering in the universe is not a particular problem for my belief in that particular God anymore. So you might think that that God belief looks rather more plausible.
Right. We'll have Alvin respond to that in a moment. You're listening to a very philosophical edition of the programme today. My great pleasure to be joined for this by Alvin Plantinga on the phone. He's one of the foremost Christian philosophers in the world. We've been talking about his evolutionary argument against naturalism. He says you can't hold rational belief in evolution and be a naturalist at the same time. We've been hearing why, and he's been interacting with Stephen Law, atheist philosopher and senior lecturer in philosophy at Heathrop College at the University of London, also a provost of the Centre for Inquiry UK. Links to both my guests with the podcast of this programme. And if you want to get in touch with your thoughts on what's been said today, then I do encourage you to email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And we're going to be concluding our discussion today on the other side of a short ad break.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So when Richard Dawkins said that Darwinian evolution enabled him to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist, was it true? And not according to Alvin Plantinga, one of the foremost Christian philosophers in the world, has spent some time developing what we're calling today the evolutionary argument against naturalism. He says actually that thoroughgoing materialist naturalism is not a good bedfellow of belief in evolution, because it undercuts it, essentially. We cannot sort of be sure that the beliefs we hold are true if they were produced in a naturalistic framework by a purely evolutionary process. It's a complex argument. I hope that in some ways we've been able to tease out some of the strands of it during the course of the programme today. Stephen Law has been helping us to do that. He is, as it were, the sceptic of that particular argument on the programme today. He's an atheist. He's senior lecturer in philosophy at Heathrop College, the University of London. So Stephen, at the end there, was telling us, Alvin, that he thinks this could work equally against theistic belief, that there's a sense in which, well, it depends what kind of God we're talking about, and if my rational faculties I appear to discover an argument against the existence of your God, then I'm equally left in a kind of sceptical, you know, quagmire, as it were. What do you say in response to that?
Uh-huh. Well, first, you mentioned Dawkins several times. I'd like I think most of what Dawkins says doesn't make much sense. I think what Stephen says makes a whole lot more sense. So, I mean, I think that just is worth pointing out.
That's
Dawkins, for the most part, as far as I can make out, is very poor at philosophy. And most of what he does, at least in his most recent book, is philosophy. So for a more sort of philosophically respectable way of being an atheist, I would recommend people like Stephen. As to his last suggestion, of course, I don't for a moment think that my cognitive faculties reveal to me that there isn't any such person as God. I think, he brings up the problem of evil, and the first thing to say is that theists have to take this problem very seriously. Theists all the way back to the Psalms in the Old Testament, and in particular Job, have found the existence of suffering and the amount of suffering and the appalling character of certain kinds of suffering found it perplexing, wondering, well, why God? Why would God permit this, you know? And you might even think that it's unlikely with respect to the existence of suffering, just taking that, suffering and evil, that there should be someone like the Christian God. Maybe so. That's a long ways, though, from my cognitive faculties revealing to me that there's no such person. That would be, you might say, one particular bit of evidence or one particular strand, one particular consideration in a much larger picture where you'd have to also think about all the things on the other side. I mean, arguments like fine-tuning arguments, Michael Behe-type arguments, arguments for morality, arguments from the nature of propositions. There's a whole bunch of arguments for the existence of God. But the main point here would be that believers in God, I would say, don't typically believe on the basis of these arguments. I mean, it's if theism is true and if Christianity is true, then there will be sources of warrant for these beliefs that are quite independent of argument from the way the world is or things of that sort.
Stephen, we're wandering into, you know, a whole other area, which again is something Alvin's written on a lot as well, the problem of suffering, etc. But do you feel that Alvin's argument here does create a problem for, and you don't put yourself in this camp as far as I understand, but a thoroughgoing naturalist, does it present a problem as far as the possibility of holding a rational belief if you are a thoroughgoing naturalist?
You mean the evolutionary argument against naturalism?
Exactly.
We're going back to that, as I say, I mean, at the beginning, let's just be clear that this is not an argument which is supposed to show that naturalism is false or is even probably false. That's just not even the intention. But it might show that someone who embraces naturalism is being somehow, you know, there's something incoherent in their position, because if they think their position through, they will discover that in combination with the theory of evolution that it's unlikely that they'll have reliable cognitive faculties. Mm-hmm. But then, as Alvin points out, if they don't have reliable cognitive faculties, you know, they can't be knowers. They can't reasonably suppose that they're a knower of the truth that naturalism and evolution are true. So, you know, it's an interesting argument, and, you know, it deserves close attention, and it's been through a number of versions as well. I've been looking at the way it's evolved, I think that the version that we've seen today is certainly a challenge, but I can't see that it's an insurmountable challenge. And I sketched out some reasons for thinking that it's really not an insurmountable challenge, that we can, if I were a naturalist, a naturalist probably can show why unguided evolution will tend to favour true beliefs. I sketched out some reasons for supposing how that would work. But look, my other point was this: that even if it turns out that we're going to have, you know, we're mired in scepticism as naturalists, we can't know anything, it doesn't follow that theism is in any better position, because it may be that, as I pointed out, theism is in much the same sceptical soup. It's if there is a God and he's given us we suppose has given us reliable cognitive faculties when we apply them. They appear to reveal very good grounds for supposing that there is no such God, in which case that undercuts our reasons for supposing that we have reliable cognitive faculties. So we end up in a similar kind of sceptical position. Of course, these are, you know, this is all very complicated, and there's so much more that might be said.
Absolutely.
But that's brief. That's kind of brief summary of what I've said.
I think so far. I think you've done a very good job though at sort of putting the case to Alvin today. Alvin, thank you for joining us on the show. Would you like to sum up as well where you feel that this leaves you? People have responded to this argument over the years. It's gone through some revisions. You've published responses as well. Do you feel like Stephen's got anywhere near sort of a kind of, I don't know, the kind of responses that you've heard, have you ever had to change it significantly in order to sort of keep the fundamental kind of principle there?
I don't think I've had to change it significantly, but it has gone through, I've been thinking about it for many years, and a lot of people have produced really interesting criticisms, and thinking about those criticisms, I have certainly changed the argument. And like any philosophical argument, it's not going to be a knock-down, drag-out argument with no possible escape from it. There aren't philosophical arguments of that sort, as far as I know. I mean, there may be one or two. My friend Edmund Gettier might have produced one. I won't go into that now. But in any event, it's not like that. But I do think it's a powerful argument. And I don't think that Stephen's response helps a whole lot. I mean, what he says basically, well, it's just more likely that underlying neurology that produces adaptive behavior will also produce, if it produces belief content at all, true belief content. I don't see the grounds for that judgment. I mean, I'm inclined to think one would think that just because that's how we think about ourselves. But we can't really import how we think about ourselves as things actually stand into the argument in that way, because what it's really about is what things would be like if materialism and naturalism and evolution were all true, and maybe they're not. I mean, I think they probably aren't, so we can't just import what we think about ourselves in that way into the argument. As for the problem of evil, it's a problem, all right, but I can't see that it's a case of our cognitive faculties revealing to us that there's no such person as God. I wouldn't think of it that way at all. I would think of it much more the way Job does in the book of Job in the Old Testament, where Job is afflicted and wonders why God permits him to be afflicted. He suffers. He's sitting there on a pile of ashes, scratching away with potsherds and the like. And he gets angry with God and says he'd like to go to court with God, but then he realizes if he did, God would be the judge and jury and executioner, all rolled into one. But he's angry. Well, what finally happens is that God comes to him. He has a kind of face-to-face experience of God. And he realizes after this experience, he realizes that even if he can't think of what reason God would have for permitting these evils, God being God would have such a reason. And after that, the storm in his soul is quieted and he's okay. For Christians, it's somewhat similar. You know, why does God permit some of the horrifying things that you read about every day in the paper? It makes one uneasy. It makes you might, in fact, if it happens to you or your loved ones, you might be angry with God. You might think, well, God's got his own great ends and so on, but why is he doing this? You might think you hate that he's doing it. But then when you, as a Christian, reflect on the central truths of Christianity, that the first being of the universe, God himself, was willing to subject the second person of the Trinity, his Son, to all the suffering involved in his being humiliated and crucified, the cruel and bitter death of the cross, as one of the creeds puts it, you realize that a being with that sort of enormous, over-the-top love would have a good reason for permitting the evils, even if you can't determine what those reasons are.
It would be fascinating to get you on again, gentlemen, to pursue that, because this is another, obviously, a big area of your work, Alvin, the free will defense of evil, the problem of evil. But perhaps another time. In the meantime, thank you very much both for being with me on the program today. Alvin Plantinga was on the phone with us, one of the foremost Christian philosophers in the world. Thank you for joining us, Alvin, today. And well, thank you. And Stephen Law, thank you for coming into the studio. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll point people towards the Centre for Inquiry, which you are very much involved in. And thank you for coming in.
Well, no, thanks to you and thanks to Alvin. I really enjoyed that. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a classic replay edition of Unbelievable, and you can get in touch with your thoughts at our show page. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And there you'll find further resources, the back catalogue of shows, and ways to support the show too. Thanks for being with us, and see you next time.